We're now finally starting from the beginning. The first few sessions we had, we obviously did things that were appropriate for the Yamim Noraim. So I'll just make mention of something that I made mention of in weeks past. Sefer Tehillim can be appreciated on many different levels. Of course, there's the level of prayer and supplication for which it's most famous. After all, upstairs they just had a Tehillim dinner. That's one mode of Sefer Tehillim, but Chazal make it very clear, and I mean, doesn't need Chazal for this, but they put it in very strong terms that I wanted to share, that David's aspirations for Sefer Tehillim were far more ambitious than just that. His ambition was that it would be studied as a serious work, as poetry, to be sure, but religious poetry, deep with meaning. Yihu l'ratzon imrei fi, David says, may my words be l'ratzon, would they be pleasing, but not just in the sense of prayer and supplication, but that they should be studied intensively, and that the schar for studying them would be no different than nega'im and ohalos, which are two very difficult parts of the Shisha Sidre Mishnah, which deal with laws of Tumantara, ritual purity. So what David is saying is that the at least the way that Chazal put it in terms of his own voice, is the importance of really trying to take a look at these things and think deeply about them, and not relating to them as cute little songs or whatever, nice little tfilos, but really much, much more than that. They're really statements of a religious philosophy. So to study any kind of philosophy requires a certain sobriety and focus and rigor, and that's hopefully what we're going to try to bring to the table here in the case of Sefer Tehillim. Sefer Tehillim, of course, begins famously. We'll just jump right in. Ashrei ha'ish asher lo halach ba'atzas reshaim uvederech ha'taim lo amad uvemoshav leitim lo yashav ki'im b'toras adonai chavtso uvesaraso yege yomam v'layla. Happy is the man who has not walked in the counsel of the wicked, nor in the way of sinners has he stood, nor in the seat of scoffers has he sat. But in the Torah of the Eternal is his desire, and his Torah, in his Torah does he meditate day and night. V'hayak et shasu al palge mayim, asher perio yitain b'ito ve'alehu lo yibol, v'chol asher yasa yatzliach. He will be like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and whose leaf does not wither, and in all that he does he will succeed. Lo chein harishayim, ki'im kamot asher tidfenu ruach, not so the wicked, who are merely like chaff that the wind drives away. Alkain, lo yakumu rishayim ba'mishpat v'chataim ba'adas tzadikim. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. Ki uvdei Adonai derech tzadikim, for the Eternal knows the way of the righteous, v'derech rishayim toved, but the way of the wicked will perish. So, that's first things first. What is the basic contrast that David HaMelech is drawing in this mizmor? In other words, there's a clear and marked distinction that David is drawing between which two groups? Okay, or in other words, just to put it in slightly different terms, use David HaMelech's own terms. Nice to see you.
The wicked and the righteous.
Okay, right. So exactly. The tzaddikim and the rishayim. Okay, so throughout this mizmor, there's a distinction which is drawn between the path of the righteous, with the derech tzaddikim, and the derech rishayim. Now, superficially, and this is really where the thrust of the shir will lie, superficially what people tend to focus on is the distinction in the behaviors, okay, between the tzaddikim and the rishayim. And it doesn't take a scholar to delineate, you know, what's the appropriate behavior for the righteous and what is the unfortunate and nefarious behavior of the wicked. And we're interested in that, but what we're even more interested in is the subtle part of the mizmor, which is the different methodology. In other words, it's not so much the behavior, the result, but the approach to life. And there's going to be a fundamental difference if you read the mizmor clearly and carefully that David is really suggesting. What is the essential and fundamental difference between tzaddikim and rishayim? What is it that truly makes them different from one another? That's really the question that we're interested in. Okay, of course the behavior is different. Tzaddikim, we understand, they study Torah. And we understand that the rishayim don't. Okay, but clearly the mizmor is saying more. You don't need David HaMelech to tell you that.
Well, the only thing I see here, which sometimes you can question whether it really happens in all cases, is the way of the wicked will perish.
Okay, right. So certainly, and this is noted by the Radak, what Arthur is pointing out, is certainly one of the things that this mizmor lays claim to is the ultimate reward and punishment. In other words, what will ultimately be the result of choosing good or evil is that you will be repaid in kind. Now, amongst the Mephoreshim, there's open question, as there is in life in general, whether this is primarily for this world or for the world to come. Well, we'll leave that question aside for now, even though Arthur is correct to point out that there's an aspect, this was already noted by the Radak, there's an aspect of, you know, what will the ultimate consequences, to use the imagery of the Mizmor itself, what will the fruit be in the end of each path respectively. But what I'm actually curious about is something of a more subtle point, how the Rishaim are portrayed and how the Tzaddikim are portrayed, and I'm going to try to develop that as we go on. Okay, so let's just keep that in the back of their mind, is how does their lifestyle differ? Not so much their ultimate choices, but the way in which they make these choices. And that's something which needs to be looked at very carefully, and for that we really have to break down this poem that we have in front of us. Now, let's start with something even more basic. This is the very beginning of Sefer Tehillim. It's the central moral document, central ethical document. Right there, Sefer Mishlei, Iyov, so they call them Sefer Emes. There's something incredibly striking about the first pasuk of Sefer Tehillim. If I was writing a document of moral exhortation, right, I would probably start by saying, what? This is what you should do. Like, I might make a list. Okay, these are the most important values in the world. You should do this. Okay, how does this Mizmor start? How does all of Sefer Tehillim start?
Ashrei.
What's that?
Ashrei.
Okay, it does start with Ashrei, but what are they praising him for?
They're not telling him what to do. They're praising him for doing what they feel is the right thing.
Okay, just sharpen a little bit. Susan is 90% of the way there. They're not praising Alan, yeah?
I mean, it's not giving a definition. It's saying don't be wicked.
Okay, 95%, but we just need a little more. We need a little better. In other words, it's not something that he did. Rather, it's...
negative.
It's something that he's not doing.
But it's also not giving you an instruction. He's setting up an example, but he's not giving you an
good instruction. Okay, that's going to be critical. We're going to return to that point. Susan, just hang on to that for a second, because that's even a secondary dimension. In other words, what's the real point? What's the praise? Alan, just sharpen it a little bit.
The praise is not being bad.
Okay, so
praise for being
correct.
Praise
okay, so now let's think about that. That's kind of remarkable. So if
being good, it makes you happy. Hashem will never be happy.
Well, right. So that returns something to Arthur before. But let's leave aside happiness for a second. So let's leave aside because, right, that is a complicated. That's a much more complicated topic because we all know
stable. He's more stable than Hashem.
Now Esther is really drilling down. Okay, we're gonna move. We're gonna
longevity, and the other one will be like a wind.
Exactly. So you're already picking up, and that's what I was referring to when I noted before that the whole method of living is different. That's something that I really want to dwell on. No pun intended, but. Just to begin with, what makes Sefer Tehillim's opening remarkable is what it does say and what it doesn't say. What it doesn't say, okay, to begin with, is doing this is really important. Actually, what it really says at the beginning is, if you want to start off on the path of goodness, the first thing that you've got to know is what not to do. In a certain sense, that's more basic and more fundamental than what to do. Okay, this is both, just one second, this is both sequential. In other words, many of the Mephoreshim point this out, that in life, oftentimes, before you really know what goodness is all about, it's much easier to detect what wickedness is. And that's what you need to stay away from. And there are various formulations here of not walking with the wicked, not standing with them, not sitting with them. And there's a certain sequence, there's an internal sequence that I'm not going to get into for now, because there's a lot to be said about that. But that be that as it may, is that what's being praised here is the capacity to avoid falling in with the wrong crowd. So much of life, especially at the outset, is just making sure that you're not actively doing something wrong. It says, David says in another place, Sur Meira, first you should avoid doing wicked or evil things, Va'asei Tov, then you can worry about making a positive contribution. There's a sequence there, there's a chronology, there's a kind of a hierarchy. Now, Chazal take this one massive step further, and they say, you know, we have a concept in Judaism that anybody who refrains from doing, you know, an evil thing, it's as if, it's almost as good, he's rewarded as if he had done a mitzvah. Kol mi sheyashev lo avar aveira ki ilu notin lo schar, ki'ilu asa mitzvah. In other words, what's this all about? It's a recognition, that's an extreme way of formulating the idea, it's a recognition that so much of the spiritual challenge in life is indeed refraining, holding oneself back, the capacity to restrain oneself. And ultimately, I think we all know that that's the way things play out. The hardest thing to do, especially at a younger stage, is, you know, when you're still differentiating yourself and determining who it is you want to be and what your priorities are, when you're still what I like to call getting invited to the party. You're getting invited to the party that you really shouldn't be going to because nothing good's going to happen there. So it takes a tremendous amount of character to do the right thing and not to go. After a little while, a month, a year, a few years, you're not going to get invited anymore. We all have had that experience, hopefully, right? Where it's no longer that same kind of active challenge. So you just follow here what the sequence is. It's first, Ashrei ha'isha shelo halach batzas rishayim, etc., etc. V'derech ha'tayim lo amad mozaleisim lo yachav. It's doing the right thing by not doing the wrong thing, and then you can worry about higher ambitions and aspirations. Ki'im b'toras Hashem cheftzo uv'saraso yege yomam v'layla. They're making a serious contribution to the world of Torah study and thought. But that doesn't come first. The first thing that one needs to do is to avoid falling into the wrong crowd. Sarah and then Alan.
I have a question as to the nature of Tehillim. I thought that Tehillim was the Sefer of David's chronic supplication to God because he was running away from being killed, and so he was praising God and thanking God and...
That's a very narrow aspect of Sefer Tehillim. There are a few mizmorim that relate to that topic, but on the whole, it's actually far broader. And there are many, many, many aspects of the human experience which are discussed. And it's really, as I noted at the outset, more of a religious philosophical text in the broadest sense of the term, which certainly speaks, perhaps more than it does to any single topic, it does speak to the experience of suffering, various forms of suffering, I should note, as we've already discussed in past weeks. But it's certainly not limited to that. It deals with both suffering and joy. Don't forget that the line, Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha, also comes from Sefer Tehillim. That shouldn't be overlooked. Alan, there was a question.
Well, I had two points, which it seemed like you didn't want to talk about.
Go ahead. I'm just triaging, because we have a limited amount of time. But anything which is of interest to you, you should bring up.
One of my points was about that. I thought that when is it that we do things? I mean, there's sort of perhaps four states of daily life. There's walking or, you know, moving around. There's sitting someplace. There's standing still. And there's also lying down and sleeping. But you don't do anything with lying down and sleep, so you don't have to dress.
Wow, yeah. Agreed.
So it's basically saying, in all of your waking life, stay away from.
Okay, Baruch Shekivanta, that is literally, the Radak says what you said verbatim, including your line about sleeping. He said that whole thing about, and it would have included sleeping, except that doesn't really count. So that's kind of amazing to me that you just articulated that, even with the aside. Nicely done. No, that was really good. So the Radak says just that.
The first pasuk is, it's sort of active things. I mean, to the extent that, you know, walking is obviously active, standing is sort of active, sitting with people is kind of it's an activity. But then what does the righteous person do? It's more just meditating. It's passive. It's passivity in a way, or, well, it's not really.
Not really passivity, but. But
it's more of thinking.
Put it together with what Esther said. If you're listening carefully to what Esther said, what did Esther say? What was that? Exactly. Exactly. Now, Alan and Esther, put your minds together, and what do you get?
Merge it.
Bring it together. Synthesize these two points, because that's really the thrust of the shiur tonight. In other words, Esther noted at the end of the Mizmor, what David is saying is contrasting is the kind of staying power of the righteous. Ve'yake eit shasol palgemayim asher piryo yitain b'ito ve'lei lo yubo v'chol asher yasa yetzlich lochein arishayim kim kamot asher tidfenu ruach. In other words, that the most important distinction for the purposes of this mizmor between the wicked and the righteous is the staying power, that certain sense of being anchored. And what Alan put his finger on, and these are obviously related points, in fact what I'll argue is that it's cause and effect, what Alan put his finger on is that What's the difference between the methodology of the tzaddik and the methodology of the rasha, so to speak? Is that what's the calling card of the righteous? The capacity to think. Think deeply. To ruminate and to meditate. It's not passivity so much as it is the powers of contemplation. Exactly. That what is lehagia? What does that term mean? It means in the heart. So the difference between the Rishaim and the Tzaddikim expresses itself in the Tzaddik thinking things through systematically and sequentially. That sense of rootedness, which comes up later in the Mizmor, is direct cause and effect, which you get from really thinking about the big things in life, thinking about them carefully and deeply over a stable and long period of time. No wonder then that the Mizmor says, he's like a tree. What's the image of a tree? What makes a tree a tree? All the beautiful things that you see about the tree emerge from its being rooted. And Chazal comment about this. It says, Eitz Shasel. Shasel is even a more deeply form of being rooted than just the other word for being planted, which is in Hebrew. What would we say if it just meant planted? Natua. Shatul is deeper than Natua. Shatul means that any wind in the world which comes along that couldn't even blow it over. So it's because of the tzaddik's deep rootedness that he has beautiful fruits and leaves, etc. But first the roots have to go down very deep. And this is all a metaphor for what it means to be a righteous person. It means to really work things through in such a way that ultimately you'll be able to bear fruit. Nobody's born righteous. Nobody is born perfect. Character development, intellectual development, spiritual development is all a process. And that is precisely what the Rishaim lack. They lack that sense of rootedness. Ki'im kamotza sher tidfenu ruach. Ultimately, what makes all the difference is not the behavior. The behavior is symptomatic. What we're interested in is how do you approach life? Are you willing to take your time? The Medrash is just a play on this theme. The Medrash says, what does it mean, Asher? Pirio yitain bi'ito, that its fruit will come in the appropriate time. It says that the truly righteous person will start giving psak, he'll start giving direction in Torah when he's ready for it, not too soon, not premature, not when he's unripe. Asher, pirio yitain bi'ito. How do they understand ve'alehu lo yibol? One of my favorite comments. Afilu sichas chulin shel tamidei chachamim tzricha limud. Even their non-Torah related speech requires study. You know, what makes it so special? Why, when they're talking about other things, when they're talking about politics, when they're talking about science, they're talking about the weather, whatever it is, why does that require study? Because it's thought out. There's a certain methodology. There's a certain deliberate quality to their approach to life, which is translatable, which transcends their particular realm of Torah, and it really characterizes everything they do, and it makes it worth analyzing carefully, even when it's not, so to speak, in their chosen field. That's the point that the Mizmor is really making, and that these are the two essential choices one has in life. One either could be amongst the Rishaim, and again, we're not keen on their behavior, that comes later, but amongst the Rishayim in the sense of being a reactive person, ultimately being caught up in one's carnal desires, constantly reacting to that, never really being able to take hold of oneself, and not merely going from thing to thing and reacting to whatever the passion of the moment is, and deeply, deeply working on oneself. That's one path that's in front of one in this world. The other path is the path of rumination, contemplation, which starts off with that hard work of restraint and digging down deep and planting the seeds and developing the roots, etc., but ultimately over the long term bears the fruits that we all, you know, that speak for themselves. This is what, you don't, again, it's all in the Mizmor, but just to put it in a slightly different vernacular, what do the behavioral psychologists call this? The single most important aspect, the single greatest predictive factor in a person's success. They can look at this at the age of 5, and it's shocking how predictive this is of success in life. Single factor, delayed gratification. Can a person delay gratification? They study 5-year-olds, and they see 5-year-olds who are best able to delay gratification. They look at their mean income. They look at their... It's an amazing predictor for all kinds of their socioeconomic status, all kinds of things. There's the family stability, etc. What's that? Everything is just delayed gratification. That's what, again, is what the Mizmor Tilim is about.
They're way to Olam Haba.
What's that? Right. Forget about Olam Haba, but just think about this world. In other words, if you're...
That delayed gratification.
Mm-hmm. That's the ultimate delayed gratification. But even in this world... Do you want to be with the Rishaim who have no roots, who never took the time to have roots, right? They just simply went for what they wanted in a very reactive, carnal sense? Or do you want to be amongst the Tzaddikim who took the time to develop that scholastic persona, that the capacity for really working through things that's reflected here in the imagery of the tree and the roots, etc.? Now, what's so fascinating about this is you'll see that Chazal picked up very much on Sefer Tehillim. The beginning of Sefer Tehillim is basically an ode to the scholastic personality and how this is the choicest of paths in life. What's the first teaching in Pirkei Avos? It's the same idea. What's the first thing that...
The first
Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, what's the first teaching? That comes to the Asara Mamaros in the sixth chapter of Pirkei Avos. Asara Mamaros Nivra Olam.
Nope. Happy, yeah.
So
the first thing is about the transmission.
Yeah, the transmission, and then it says, "Anshe Knesses Hagadola, Heimam Rushlosh Advarim." What were the three things that they said? The first of those three was, "Heavy Misunim Badin." Be very deliberate in judgment. In other words, what does that mean? It means develop the kind of approach to life which first and foremost has that aspect of deliberation. You're really going to think through things and really make choices instead of making what I like to call very reactive, instinctive, I wouldn't even call them choices, but sort of instinctive reactions as opposed to deliberated choices. That's the theme of Sefer Tehillim at the beginning, and that's the theme of Pirkei Avos. Because all of the good things that we associate with our religious tradition are only potentiated by a scholastic personality, a choice-oriented, deliberation-oriented approach to life, which is so much the substance of the first Mizmor Tehillim. Yeah, Arthur.
You don't think, that sounds like a pessimist.
No, sure, go ahead.
That there are very calculating, wicked people who are very successful, and they think everything out, and they're there to take advantage of everyone in every situation. I see this in business from time to time, and you wonder when they're going to get their true deserves. It never happens.
So I want to return to that point, but okay, Alan and then Esther. Yeah, Alan, go ahead.
It doesn't say that just to meditate in any fashion that you want. It says meditate at all. I think you're right, Mark.
Really?
But ultimately,
meditation has to be directed in a certain deliberation.
Okay, so I would actually try to answer it even more frontally, because I actually think that there's a difference not just in the substance of the meditation, but in the meditation itself, as I'll come back to in a second. But Esther had a question or a comment.
So what I want to know is, in this paragraph, do you see a definition of the Shayan?
I think
the first sentence has something about a Tzat Shayan.
Right. So no.
So
the,
I would say this is. I'm just looking at this book for the first time.
Yeah.
Who are the Rishayim, according to this?
So I think that it's a very good observation. I think it dovetails with our
this day and age of moral relativity. You have to tell me what's a Rasha.
Right. So I think that the hint is, in this case, that we don't say what the Rishayim's behaviors are, because we're less interested in that. What we're really interested in is that imagery of Lochein HaRishayim, the verse that you, Esther, yourself noted at the beginning, Ki'im Kamotz Asher Tidfenu Ruach, the idea that the Rishayim are they're unrooted. It's not so much their behavior that we're interested in, but what we're interested in is the fact that their decisions aren't deeply rooted. What they really are is what I like to call reactive or self-interested.
And if that's the case, I wouldn't necessarily call the Rishayim.
I think that's, in a certain sense, the chiddush of the Mizmor, is that what makes all the difference between the tzaddik and the rasha, and this is a bold claim, but I do believe it, is the capacity that the individual has to develop a value system which is not primarily self-interested. And ultimately, this is my response to what Arthur said. Indeed, there are people who think very deeply about doing terrible things. And they plan it all out, and they're very strategic about it.
And
but
some of them think of themselves as being religious.
Yeah, that's a whole different topic. But ultimately, what are their impulses? What motivates them? What stands behind whatever reasoning they do? Is it deep thought? is there some deeper confrontation with reality, some the sense of struggling existentially with the meaning of life, or is it I'm going to think in a very sophisticated way about a very primitive and primal thing, namely to get what I want, to advance myself, to get more money, to get more pleasure, to get more prestige, etc. That is what I mean by a lack of rootedness. There's not a serious confrontation here with the meaning of life. Right? What is life all about if all you're doing here is scheming to advance yourself? Then what was the point of it all? So yes, it could be very ruminative, it could be very strategic in a sense, but it will never be deep. The only... Yeah, Shira.
I work with a lot of ex-criminals.
Right.
What I spent a lot of making doing, one of them today was in prison for 30 years, and he spends a lot of his day trying to get away with things. Very, very intelligent man, to scheme how to get away with murder, how to get away with different things. But his sort of tikkun is actually trying to restrain his impulses and trying to, say, no, I don't want to do that. Not just for the sake of not going back to prison, but for the sake of some morality. And, so I think it can be this almost a psychological problem. I think that's the other problem with differentiating, if someone has like psychopathology, I'm just diverging.
No, go ahead.
Thinking about, I know it sounds silly, but in the movie Pretty Woman, I don't know if you've seen it, she says something which I think about a lot. She says the bad stuff is easier to believe. And I think psychologically, it's much easier to believe negative things that one hears. And when I read this, I can't help thinking about Lashon Hara and the amount of difficulty and the challenge that one faces when they try to not believe not take it at face value and go deeper and do big down kaslut and just say, I'm not going to let that just seep into my consciousness. I'm going to hold back and try to look at it from a deeper perspective and think about it more and really think, is this even possible? For some reason, Lashon Hara is something that just layers out there.
So I'm very happy Shira was articulating these ideas, because if I, again, just to return to the central thesis that we're laying out tonight, there's not so much a difference between a person could be wicked or good and think very deeply about their course, but the difference is ultimately what stands behind it. A person who's being admired here by David HaMelech is the kind of person who has a deep confrontation with reality, what I would call an existential confrontation, and asks serious questions. So what is the meaning of this? And so he invests in things of eternal value, Torah, as the classical example pointed out by Alan. The Rasha has no rootedness. He might think very deeply about his schemes. It might be a Moshav Leitzim. Might be literally a Moshav Leitzim, a place where people sit around and talk. They might be talking about their scheme in a very sophisticated way, but it will never be deep. It will never be ethically, morally, and philosophically deep. It will only be motivated by very primal things like self-interest, and self-interest in a variety of different ways. Lustful self-interest, monetary self-interest, etc., etc. And that's what makes all the difference. Can a person, use Shira's terminology, can a person ever graduate from thinking about themselves and trying to, achieve some kind of short-term gain here, and move to a state of being in this world where they really value things that don't necessarily revolve around themselves? They're able to invest in things that we perceive as eternally valuable, namely the Torah. That's him. Ki'im b'Torah Hashem cheftzo. What is it that he ultimately wants? It's Torah Hashem. Uvisaraso yehege yomam v'layla. And that desire for things of eternal significance really pervades his entire personality. That's a very ambitious... that's an ambitious scheme that David HaMelech has laid out here. How many people achieve that? A small number. But that's something that we should aspire to. V'kim b'taras Hashem cheftzo. Where ultimately, we put that eternal truth, deep values, the values of the Torah, at the very center of our human existence. Now, Chazal have a critical, critical comment here. You'll notice a transition. Ki'im b'toras Hashem cheftzo, uvisaraso yehege yomam v'layla. what's the difference between the two times Torah is referenced in this pasuk? Ki im b'Torah Hashem cheftzo uvisoraso yage yomam v'layla. First is described. Dana, go ahead.
Maybe first you want it, then you study it.
Okay, well, certainly there's this question of desire. Cheftzo, very good. That his desire, instead of the desires of the wicked, which we're asserting are fundamentally self-interested, what this person was looking for was something deeper, something more rooted, something more eternal, namely Torah. But what, just sharpen it a little bit, Dana, Torah is described first and foremost as... Torah's Hashem. It belongs to God. What happens by the end of the pasuk?
Oh, then it's man's.
Torah shalo, yeah. Torah so. So what made that transition? What makes all the difference? What allows it to go from Torah's Hashem to Torah so?
When he makes his own involved with it and studying it every day.
A lifetime of investment is what the Gemara says. In other words, that this is an amazing thing about Torah studies, that it starts off as the Torah of God. It's, right, by definition, when you're first starting out, first years and decades, right, you're assimilating not just new information, but a new thought system, a new way of thinking about the world, something fundamentally outside of yourself. Again, this is all reinforcing the theme of, are our basic choices motivated by self-interest, or are we submitting to a system of eternal values, which is outside of ourselves? That's what Torah Hashem is all about. But through, and this I would hasten to emphasize, only through, there is no other way, this is sine qua non, only through intensive study and investment can you transition it from Torah Hashem to Torah So, and make it your own. To the point where the person has integrated it, it's not just a question of technical mastery, though that is the beginning of it, but after you achieve a certain fluency, you're an insider, literally, then it really does become your own. And not just your own in the sense of your technical competence, right? You've developed the skills to study Torah on a very high level, which really does take decades. But more than that, the values become your own as well. In other words, what you want, this is an amazing thing in life, a person can get to the point where they're no longer, right? This goes back to an issue that I try to touch on, the difference, the Maimonides' dispute with Aristotle about what the path of goodness was, but where a person is no longer having to actively restrain himself from doing evil things, but ultimately this is his desire. His desire is to, you know, it's his Torah. The values are now his own. You know, he wouldn't have it any other way. I'm not saying that even, you know, a person gets to that place where it's all the time, then a person would be an angel, but you can see a trajectory there. And that's a remarkable transition. Yeah, Sarah.
There's something interesting here. There's lots with walking, so like doing, communicating, talking, the council is talking with people, communicating. So what of nature and nurture, like having a good heart? So if the intent is there, that leads one to the thought, to the answer to the thoughts and to the questions, versus if someone's heart, like if he wants to address nature, right? Someone whose heart is not, is going to have a harder time to, I guess the same idea, like have a harder time to struggle with the answers to these questions, versus if somebody's been given a good heart, then they communicate and walk in those ways because that's what God gave them too.
Okay, so I just want to stress this point. I think that in this mizmor, there is a decided emphasis on a person's actions as opposed to any kind of whatever their nature was, whatever their given nature is. Notice it's all about choices. It's all about choices. Ashrei ha'ish asher lo halach ba'atzas reshaim uv'derech chataim lo amad uv'moshav leitzim lo yashav. It all started with good choices. Where not to go, who not to go there with, what not to do. Ki'im b'toras Hashem cheftzo, he made it his own, uv'saraso yege yomam v'alayla. It's all about good choices and nothing was preordained. There's no magic bullet here. It's just the blood, sweat, and tears that one can invest in making good choices. So we have no indication of, you know, whether this person was inclined towards it or not. To me, it sounds, if anything, like not, right? That it really did require an enormous amount of effort. It wasn't diffusion, it was active transport, right? It was, you know, it required, it was an energy-consuming process, in that sense of the term. But because of those good choices, the results were profound. What's that?
See, what I don't understand is if he makes the Torah Toya, if he makes it
his own,
then everything, Asher Yaseh Yatzliach. B'chol Asher Yaseh Yatzliach. That doesn't necessarily happen.
Oh, 100%. That's what we were alluding to at the beginning when Arthur raised the question. And I think the commentaries are split as to what this means and if it's even quantifiable in this world. But what we can, to the extent that I think it is referring to things in this world, because again, theodicy is always a question, it's one of the central motifs of Sefer Tehillim, is that there's a certain gushpanka, there's a certain brand that this person brings to his life. V'chol asher yaseh yatzliach, I think, pertains less to, okay, this is quantitative and quantifiable success, but that he does things the right way. There's a certain methodology. It's what I like to call value investing in the spiritual sense, you know, playing off Buffett. When Warren Buffett talks about methodology of investing, he's less interested in, you know, did you make, how much money did you make? But the process by which one goes about making investment choices, that's the way that I understand this. Asher Pirio Yitain Be'ito V'chol Asher Yaseh Yatzliach. This is a person who's not taking shortcuts. This is a person who's putting in an honest effort. So whatever the short-term results are, whether it's successful or not successful, that can depend on many things, often things outside of one's own control. There's a certain brand. The person puts in an honest day's work, and that is evident in his spiritual caliber. And that's, to me, what it means anyway, of Asher Pirio Yitain Be'ito V'chol Asher Yaseh Yatzliach, is whatever is going on in his life, you see that sense of control, that sense of steadiness, of steadfastness, that sense of rootedness where everything is deliberated, which I think is an incredibly admirable thing. A person can always be wrong. But I think we know in life that the people that we trust and the people that we think will be right most often are the ones that really think through things. They're not those who shoot from the hip. But those who are the proverbial Toraso Yege Yoman Valaila types, that they really think it through, they're deep, they're rooted, that kind of person is a trustworthy and reliable person. As opposed to people who again, are fundamentally self-interested, and everything that they do is on that basis. And lochein harishaim kim kamotza shertid veneruach, those people have no legacy. Ultimately, the wind comes along and blows them away, and there's no sense of rootedness or long-lasting contribution that they can make, because ultimately what they were about in this world was advancing their own interests. A person makes their life about advancing their own interests, so then as soon as those interests aren't around anymore, they have no legacy to speak of.
I still have a hard time considering them Rishayim.
Considering, what's that?
Considering them Rishayim.
Well, that's...
just another kind of God's creatures.
Well, but then you're back to a kind of moral relativism, because if it's just another kind of God, God makes, right, God is responsible for everything in this world. I mean, again, that's what Yeshayahu says of, you know, Oseh Tov Uvoreh Asara, that God does allow for wicked things in this world, but ultimately, if you say, you know, sort of what's the root of evil? So, to me, this Mizmor Tehillah makes the argument that the root of evil is never moving beyond a kind of self-interested perspective on life. If you really stay rooted in that, then terrible things can happen. You know, it starts off with small things where a person is self-interested in a very inconsequential way, but then it can become...
But until that person becomes abusive, he's not a Russia.
Yeah. Well, but how? But that's I think that's a... I would agree. But that's a very fine line. Because...
I actually think
David HaMelech is in agreement with you. I think you would agree that there's not a rush until that point. The point is that you cross that threshold pretty quickly.
Is a rush in training?
I think that's right.
Really?
I actually think that's a very good formulation.
Right.
I like that formulation very much.
When you think of a person who's self-centered, there's always the chance that that person will step on other people to achieve his goals. And then when they do that...
Probability, a likelihood.
Yeah.
Because ultimately that's what life is trying to balance self-interest with the needs of others. And for a person who really is fundamentally self-interested, it's not going to take a lot... You don't become Bernie Madoff overnight. But you have a person with a certain basic self-interested orientation, and it doesn't have to be that extreme, but one thing leads to another, and then you have a disaster on your hands. But nobody becomes, you know...
Self-interest is a survival instinct.
But the question is what are the counter-pressures? And what this Mizmor is talking about is when you don't, and I think this is what Shira was saying as well, is when a person can't develop that deeper spiritual persona and stay self-interested, then it's a very fine line between...
You're doing things lishma.
What's that?
You're doing things lishma.
Right, that's the ultimate ambition. That's the ambition of uvetaraso yege yomam v'layla. That's what we're all... Dana, you want to make a comment about that?
No, I just can't hear what he said.
Okay. No, what Arthur was saying is that a person who's self-interested, even in a trivial way, Arthur called that a rasha in training. What's the Torah model that we have for that, by the way? We have a Torah model where... person hasn't done anything that horrible yet, but that even where somebody hasn't even done anything that terrible yet, but correct, Ben Sora Amora, where a person has developed a character that's fundamentally narcissistic and hedonistic, even though it's more of a theoretical model than anything else, the Torah says that person can only do evil in this world, and we root them out before they have the opportunity. That's what we call Nidon al Shem Sofo. That's a fascinating concept, and what the concept is really suggesting is that once a certain perspective is entrenched, a perspective that's basically self-interested and rooted in pleasure, that starts off again as, okay, well, how is this harming other people? But quickly it does. In relationships, person is self-interested, destroy other people, financially, and otherwise. So, I think Esther's comment really highlights that in a certain way, namely, that what starts off as what we would perceive as fairly innocuous self-interest quickly becomes true rishus, true evil. Because when a person grows up and is in the real world and isn't just a child anymore, again, children can be cruel to each other also, but it becomes very, very, very dangerous. Yeah, Shira.
Hard to imagine someone had a very difficult traumatic childhood and they're reacting to preserve themselves because they've learned to have those instincts to just, you know, survive. There's, you know, principle of like ego syntonic and ego dystonic, where you feel like, you know, if it's syntonic, then you don't realize that what you're doing is really wrong. It's just part, it's combined with your ego. If it's dystonic, then you realize if something's off and hopefully you want to change it, you want to improve upon it. And so I think that's maybe the point of maybe someone can't help it, but if someone knows they're doing wrong and they want to do better, even if it's very hard for them, I think that might be the differentiation, like pointing out to someone that it's wrong.
Many people will never make that transition successfully, and that's what the basic concern of the Mizmor is that. What enables that transition, at least in my reading of the Mizmor, is a little bit of contemplation. Doing that work, what I call the critical word of the Mizmor, the Taraso Yehege Yomam Valaila, that word, that singular word, which means to think, to consider, and to ruminate. Character building is done in those moments of psychological exertion. That, working through things, thinking through them, and developing in that way is enormously taxing, but can make all the difference. And that ultimately, I think, is what makes the difference between the Derech Rishayim and the Derech Tzaddikim. Remember that this person, this prototypical religious man, so he started off with a choice in front of him, and he's being praised for not going down the path of wickedness. V'derech Rishayim lo halach, Moshev leitzim lo yashav, etc. And by the end of the Mizmor, right, the paths are separated like east and west. The Derech Rishayim is utter destruction. The Derech Tzadikim is with Hashem, right? But they started off much closer together. They didn't diverge until the very end of the Mizmor. They started off very close. What enables sort of that diversion, that divergence, is the development. It's person developing. And again, that's why I wanted to stress to Sarah, I don't think that these things are preordained at all. This goes back to conversation that Sarah and I have been having about free will, but that ultimately, these things are basically choices. We're responsible for those choices, whatever the circumstances of our lives are. They're obviously mitigating circumstances. People have been born into very, you know, again, there are mitigating circumstances, but ultimately, the moral outcome of our life is basically our choice, as opposed to other outcomes of our life, the financial outcome, the health outcome, etc. Ultimately, the moral outcome is a choice. And ultimately, the choice starts, I believe, with not doing the wrong thing, aspiring to do the right thing, and then developing through the power of Torah study, but even more than that, contemplation, Torah contemplation, that's the method for character development. Now, what I always like to point out is that even though behaviorism is very much in vogue, I don't just mean psychologically, she is more qualified to speak to that than I am, obviously, but in the religious world where people talk in very behaviorist tones about the need to do things and then it will sort of come, I don't see this mizmor in that framework. I think this is much more an intellectual approach. If I'm correct in asserting that the linchpin is b'toraso yehege yomam v'layla, that it's the process of study that makes all the difference, I think it's more of an intellectual approach than a behavioral one. Thinking that will make the difference in doing that psychological work. That would be called, to put it in the vernacular, that would be called more of an analytic approach than a behavioral one. And I think Rambam in general takes that approach as well. Yeah, was there a comment down there?
I'll make one.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. Yeah, I thought you raised your hand. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know. I read it a little differently. I read it.
Go ahead, sure.
The first pasuk, you know, Ashrei Ha'ish, like, fortunate is the person who doesn't do the bad thing. And then if you read it, like, you kind of have that initial, it's a very slight, like, you know, leaning toward it's better to live, you know, a moral life, like, or good for people who don't do, you know, bad things and then follow wicked ways.
Right.
And then, you know, Pasuk Bet is like the second step, Ki'im B'Torah Hashem Fetzo, because if his will is kind of to do what the Torah says, like, you have the initial impulse, like, it's probably better to be a good person. And then,
but remember, this is study, not action. That's where I guess we part ways.
That study turns into action, right? So if you really want to be that kind of person, then and everything you said,
but
study, then it will ultimately, like, reveal the goodness.
But the emphasis is not on the... What makes the difference here is the study.
V'toraso yege yomam v'layla. That's the action. But the beginning, I feel like...
Well, I would say study and not action. Study.
Well, the action is study.
Okay, fine. But let's just make that clear. It's not going out and doing a lot of good works.
True.
This is important because I don't think this is emphasized nearly enough, is that study, the capacity of study to shape oneself by really thinking through things, I think is the hallmark of the religious hero of this mizmor. What makes this person a religious hero was exactly because he developed the capacity to sit and to study, which is an undervalued trait today. Especially in a kinetic environment, you know, where there's constant stimulation, to really sit and to work through texts and to work through ideas and to analyze them and to shape one's personality that way, that is an enormously undervalued characteristic, to the point where we've already... This is a very sad thing from my point of view, is that we really differentiate at so young an age. Instead of taking a child and saying, okay, well, they can develop these things, which is the way that traditionally I think people thought about it. You know, you develop this, you're not necessarily born with it. If a kid, you know, shows that they're a little less inclined towards this at the beginning, they just immediately differentiate them and say, oh, okay, well, he must not be an academic type. He must... That's a shame, because these things don't have to be natural. They're actually very difficult and have to be worked on. But the payoff is enormous. And I always just like to try to emphasize this point as much as possible. If the ultimate... to me, what the most important, as I mentioned before, the most important religious characteristic is the capacity to control oneself. It's an enormously difficult thing to do. It's obviously not valued in society. The society that we live in today has actually inverted that and said that as long as your choices basically don't harm anybody, self-control isn't a value. what the value is self-expression, not self-control. But remember, this is a different perspective. The Jewish person, Ashrei Yishasher Lo Halach Batzas Rishayim, that control really does matter. So what is the single best way to develop self-control? Actually, study. Because what is study if not a repeated action of self-control? You want to get up, you want to put the book down, you want to go off and do something less rigorous and taxing, but once you develop that control, the ability to sit and to control, ultimately you're able to translate that to the realm of action, where you won't behave carnally, reactively, and instinctively. You'll be able... What allows a person to make that control? Is it some magic bullet? No, but it's hours and hours and hours of practice of self-control. What do we call that? We call that studying. Because studying is, by definition, an act of self-control.
But that's
really important. It's important for a person to inflict that pain on themselves, I think. Yeah.
When this was written,
yeah,
you're talking about study, about a person who came later and had a lot to study in the Middle Ages. And later, we had a lot more to study. When this was written, there was only the Torah and a few other things. There was no Gemara, there was no this, there was no that. That all came later.
So one brief word on that is that there was a massive amount of Gemara, just none of it had been written down yet.
Yeah, but so you have to study it with people. They're only talking here about studying the Torah. Unless they're talking about being in a place and studying with people, where you learn from people.
Yeah, this just here it doesn't actually use. Susan is absolutely correct in pointing out that it was my. I took a liberty in saying that it had to be textual studying. Here the verb which is used is much more ruminative. In other words, right, reflecting on whatever the lessons of the day were. But remember, the entire oral law was oral before it was ever written. That was a very late thing that it was written. So the absolute majority of the corpus of oral law, as you know, what we call today the Talmud, had been developed, but not actually written down. So there was still a massive corpus. Right, exactly. So it wasn't just the 24, you know, books or, you know, but really this massive amount, which is, what Moshe, you know, on down, that's, you know, what Moshe relayed to Joshua, etc., etc. There was a question down there? Go ahead.
What you were just saying, that there were strengths and the power in the restraint, kind of reminded me about what we were talking about last week, the not reacting and not kind of holding back or forgiving is more powerful.
Restraint, exactly. Yeah, I think that's a great parallel. It didn't even occur to me. But it's just important to recognize that I guess we'll conclude with this point, because I do want to let people go a few minutes early, is that that which is so undervalued or not valued or just demeaned by society, this the act of self-control, is such an elemental part of the religious experience. And we don't tend to think of that as heroic, because we don't live in a world that celebrates that. We live in a world that, if anything, celebrates small moments of, if you say, who's a hero? Say, oh, somebody who runs into a building and saves a family that was, okay, that's a wonderful thing to do. But ultimately, from our perspective, as iconoclastic as this is, that's not the highest level of heroism. The highest level of heroism is a lifetime of small, really good choices, and not just one moment of a massive and very overt good choice. But small, everyday good choices most often come in restraint. Everybody who's ever dieted knows that, and that's true in so many other areas of life, where it's exactly what you don't do that gives you the capacity to then translate that into what you do do. But restraint is a real forgotten ethic, to the point where, again, you know, we're living in a time where the very notion of restraint is under siege. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, we recognize that many, many, many good things in life depend on developing the capacity to what we call either delay gratification or sometimes simply to forego it. Yeah. Oh, is that a hand? Okay. Okay, good. So we'll hold it up there, and we're going to pick it up next week. We should meet